Dispatches from the car.
Mama Africa.
Audio reports from the World Social Forum 2011 in Dakar, Senegal. Produced for broadcast on campus community radio stations globally. In this segment of Dispatches from Dakar, we will hear an interview with Blessing Kurumbinza, activist and researcher at the Socioeconomic Institute of South Africa, speaking on corporate agricultural land grabs throughout Africa and grassroots struggles for food and economic sovereignty. In this interview, we will hear about the relationship between current international corporate practices in Africa within a historical lens of European colonization.
My name is Blessing Kurumbinza, born Zimbabwean, residing in South Africa. I would like to think of myself as a son of the soil, having grown up in a rural peasant society, and then was fortunate to go through the whole education system until I got a PhD, Economic History and Development Sociology, which is a frame that I use both the rural upbringing and the imagination it has allowed me to have of another life possible when rural communities have access to resources. So in my work with NGOs and civil society in Southern Africa and on the African continent, I look at and understand myself as a voice of the voiceless in terms of my having been fortunate to go through the intellectual system to understand the global Africa space and moment in the global capitalist system.
So there's a lot of issues today in southern parts of Africa around land grabbing and the utilization of African lands for mining and also for the corporate production of agriculture, and huge numbers of peasant communities, but also the environment is being very affected by this issue. I don't know if you could talk about some specific examples that you feel are important for people to know about and highlight this general issue and the importance for social justice movements globally to understand it.
Evidently, one of the most important things to underscore is the fact that this is nothing new. Land grabbing is a more sophisticated continuation of colonial expansion, where for in the end of the 19th century, colonization was about removing people from their land. These were concessionary companies with the support of European governments through after the Berlin Conference on Africa, which decided to partition Africa. And the approach was to go to traditional leaders, negotiate for land, or if they resisted, kick them out of the land through soldiers and arms. The current manifestation of this process is again through international funding, either national or public funding, supporting multinational companies that are again coming to modern, so-called modern African states, which are just intermediaries of the Western imperialists and local communities, and talking about development, employment creation through projects such as mining, the expansion of agrofuels, the expansion of the plantation models through eucalyptus, pine, and wattle. This has now, in the very recent instance, been linked to climate change, where people are now saying they have now commodified oxygen in the air. We can plant trees on your land and we give you carbon credits and you make money out of it. And the net effect of this process is that people's land has been taken away. And the multinational corporations, we have green resources in Tanzania, Mozambique, Senegal, Mali, and Swedish companies in Mali and other places, American companies such as Monsanto, Cargill, and many other seed companies, uh-huh. and organizations or foundations such as the Linda and Bill Gates Foundations, coming in to take away people's food sovereignty and access to seeds, taking the land and uh-huh. proliferating crops such as jatropha, oil palm, which are not part of the everyday cultural collection of society and the way African communities live their lives, in the name of employment creation, in the name of economic beneficiation, and all those kind of things, because it's all within the capitalist model. Uh-huh. It's all part and parcel of the way the global system manages the world economy. To an extent, there is a lot of racism, in the sense that your Anglo-Saxon interests can easily come and put their pressure on black African communities for their land, taking advantage of poor legislation, taking advantage of poor state systems, and to enforce where, in the case of South Africa, there is good legislation in some areas, but that legislation cannot be enforced because there is no capacity, because attention is put elsewhere. So those are, in a broader sense, the manner in which these multinational corporations, through Western public funding and private funding, continue to support this land grabbing and the undermining of livelihood systems and creating of dependencies and secondary levels of poverty and unsustainable livelihood for the African communities.
Your perspective on land grabs and its relationship to concepts of development is obviously a critical one. So can you offer your critique on the corporate framework of development projects in Africa in regards to land?
What they do before they take land, they identify land and say it's marginal, it's not developed, it's not used properly and economically, and it all uses a Western frame of understanding marginality or non or economic use, and ignoring the fact that the people who live on the land make economic use of it. They have ways of adapting to it, and some of this land being semi-arid, being dry, being tropical, being semi-desert and so forth, cannot actually sustain the kind of models that they bring in. And in the first...
What do you mean, like what models?
Plantation models, for instance, these large-scale, intensive production, and which actually become water-wasting and land-wasting, and actually also not contributing to food sovereignty, food self-sustenance of the community. So they come and use this model of development, which is about employment creation, which is about economic beneficiation. And how this becomes possible is that the African states have bought into this kind of thinking, that for you to develop your society, you need to create employment. And employment is seen as wage labor. The idea of our peasant family farms as employment has been bastardized, has been seen as something that is not sustainable, because historically, through colonial rule, land reform processes, land seizures, and land alienation has pushed people away from productive land and make them suppliers of cheap labor. This is a new form of slavery and slave trade, where people go look for employment in mining, in cheap labor, in outsourced labor regimes, which do undermine their ability. So what it has done is it splits the family as an institution, which historically and culturally was a site of production and reproduction. So you have the men working in cheap labor and not even getting a family wage. a sustainable wage that can sustain the family and the woman and the children in the rural area on a piece of land that is small, fragmented, not even linked to the market, and not unable to sustain the food supply. So what you have is a creation of dependency that is long-term system. That means that the rural space is not an economic space, but a site of reproduction of labor, cheap labor, for the urban area. And yet the urban area itself is not adequately absorbing the surplus, the people from the rural area. As a student of economic history, my understanding of the origin of the proto-industrial experiment in Great Britain is that the enclosure system pushed the surplus people from the rural area into wage labor. And the manner in which, through revolutions and pressure in the British Parliament and so forth, was that what you find in developed countries today is that a small fraction of people stay in the rural area as the producers, but they produce at an economic level that they produce for the mass consumption of the people in the urban area. And there is a correlation in the price of food and the price of goods, and there is a negotiation there. If you look at African political economy, the urban unions, the industrial urban unions in the urban areas, do not see themselves and their struggle of labor as related to the struggle of the people in the rural area. So, a union would go and push for cheap food, for instance. We want cheap food for our workers to meet the level of the wages. And yet the price at the farm gate for the farmer in the African farming area is depressed and kept low by politicians and unions conniving to get elections and keep elected, which means that the African farmer cannot get to a level where he can begin to produce and compete with enough sustainability that meets the level of the global producer. This is where, again, institutions like the World Trade Organization, institutions like technology transfer and so forth, become very important for Africans and African farmers to control and to have a say in the manner in which the trade agreements, the cheap food coming from abroad, undermining rural and African production. So when we talk about climate justice, when we talk about social justice, this should be seen within that broader context, where you cannot delineate or compartmentalize political justice from human rights, from social economic justice, from the right of African indigenous communities to determine how they want to use their land, how they want to use their resources. Coming to the question of mining and land, for instance, multinational corporations and Western skills should only be brought in where technology is needed, but actually as the workers. And the Africans should own the mines, should own the land, and they should be the people determining the contract between those who have the skills and those who have the land, to a point where a devolution plan, a plan of action that says within 5-10 years we should have had technology transfer. Why is it that Anglo Gold Ashanti, Anglo De Beers, and all these Anglo-Saxon companies have been mining in Africa for the past 100 years, and yet even oil in Nigeria and so forth, and yet those skills are still vested in few Anglo-Saxon white males and females, and the black people are not having those skills? Come to education system, for instance. The African medical curricula is still channeled and designed in a way to benefit Europe. Any medical graduate, legal graduate, or any skilled graduate coming from African institutions can go and work in Europe, because that's how the curriculum is meant. And this also is one way African governments are undermined. African people, we push for free education. The state pays for that. Once the people finish the education, they get the skills, they go and work in higher wages in Europe, and skills are short in Africa. African doctors cannot treat malaria, but they can treat all these sicknesses of these bourgeois middle class sicknesses, ulcers and everything else. We have not got to a point where even our engineering departments can only measure distances across the bridge, but they can't make bridges. We still have Chinese, Koreans and all these foreigners coming to construct key infrastructure in Africa. And yet we have had 50 to 100 years of university education. What are we producing? Where are all those skills and the budgets we are producing going to? So for me, the struggle for justice, the struggle for human rights, the struggle for independence has to be an intergenerational cultural process in which Africa transcends across Anglophonism, Lusophonism, Francophonism, which is our colonial heritage. We fought the primary narrow political battles against the French, the English. We never won those battles. That's why, for instance, today we are still Anglophone Africa, is still members of the Commonwealth of the Queen, and America is not, but they were an European and English colony because they won the battle against the English. We did not. When we were close to winning the battle, we were brought to negotiations. This is what we're still doing. We're negotiating, we talk. We need to get beyond this psychological twilight zone of independence where we are talking about political independence, where we have a flag and an anthem, but the economy is still in the hands of a minority few white conglomerates, to get to a pan-African, intergenerational, culturally African, political, economic, revolutionary command, having that second level of the revolution to start to relieve and liberate our African resources.
In regards to everything you spoke about the independence of Africa, the relationship between corporations and environmental degradation, the commodification of the environment and human beings, how do all these issues for you come to a head with the upcoming climate summit in Durban? Is that important?
The climate summit is the in Durban is a conference, is a meeting, a conglomeration of polluters. It is run by the United Nations, a failed state. It is a process that I do not think is a legitimate process. It's a process controlled by few, the G8, the G7, those that have the control and the say because of their resources, control what happens at the UNFSS. When people speak like they did at Cochabamba, they disregard that. When people went to Kyoto and came with a Kyoto Protocol, they refused that and came up with the Copenhagen Accord. They came with the Cancun Agreement. They want to push it in Durban. So this is by civil society going to these things. We just are running around round circles, in a sense legitimizing a process that is an illegitimate process by a body that has shown again and again that it is a toothless body. The effect that America could go and invade the people of Iraq, the people of Afghanistan to protect their interest in the United Nations could only make a statement and a resolution and do nothing concrete to stop that, shows that the United Nations and its process are useless processes. Cochabamba, rally around friendly nations like Bolivia and all the other poor nations of the world and say this is a program of action for the people. But unfortunately, the corporates are organized, they have something to give, they are giving so-called employment, they have people, they give these piecemeal benefits, current and immediate, and the other side has nothing besides rhetoric. The other side has nothing besides fancy speeches and meeting, talking to the converted. We do not have, if Monsanto comes to a community in South Africa and say to them, here are seeds, the other side would say, do not take those seeds. We do not have a collection of indigenous certified seeds that are culturally sensitive to give as an alternative. So we need alternative, we need practical alternative, we need to go beyond rhetoric to action, we need to begin to benefit our communities practically. And for me, this is where the NGO world is a failure. Also, it has become like the missionary church under colonialism and apartheid, just making loud sounds and noise against apartheid and colonialism. Instead, if all the money NGOs are spending in all these meetings, we're going into communities, into countries, community by community, to build economies of resilience that employ people there, we would have a difference.
Mama Africa.
You have been listening to an interview with Blessing Karambinza, activist and researcher at the Socioeconomic Institute of South Africa, speaking on corporate and agricultural land grabs in Africa and contemporary struggles for food and economic sovereignty. For more information, visit www.seri-sa.org. That's www.seri-sa.org. Music in this report by Makan J of Senegal. This interview has been produced for broadcast on campus and community radio stations globally by Stefan Christoph. Makan J.